This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Good Friday, if you so indulge. I've always said, okay, as a Christian, I'm a Christian. I've always said, do you think Jesus would be calling it a Good Friday? Never mind.
That's a good point. Yeah,
I don't think you thought it was so good. I always loved. Did you ever see there was a bit with Michael Palin? And they were talking about Life of Brian, which, of course, you know, kind of talks about Jesus and all that stuff. And he was talking about religious jokes that they decided not to go with. And he was talking about the Last Supper. And he's like, the restaurant trying to take the reservation for that one. It's like, oh, what size of your group? 13. Yeah, we can put two tables together. What's that? All on one side of the table. Oh, that might be a little difficult. I do like that. If you do indulge, we got Passover, we got Easter, I've got a lot of great holidays going on. Have a wonderful weekend, no matter what. I might be, see if we can dig up Judy Garland and Easter Parade for the show, the song at the end.
There's an outside the box choice there. Yeah,
yeah, and she hasn't had a lot of hits lately. Yeah. Hasn't been scorching up the charts. You know, Brett, it's that time of year where we, of course, it's you know, get a little snow, starts to warm up, things like this. But there is always one thing that happens every spring that you know spring has come to Minnesota. Byron Buxton was left a game because of an injury. There you go.
It's funny, I didn't even know this. Patrick texted me and said, guess what happened? Byron Buxton's got hurt. So
Mr. Glass.
Yeah, yeah.
That nickname is the best nickname for that dude, man. Mr. Glass. He injured himself in his 500th game as a Twin on Friday. The Twins, it might be wild to play his 501st. He suffered a leg injury while sliding into second base during the first inning of Friday's game at Fenway Park, immediately walked off the field with Nick Gordon taking his place. The injury occurred after Buxton hit a high pop-up to shallow left center, and the winds fooled shortstop Xander Bogaerts, left fielder Alex Verdugo. The ball fell between the infielders. Buxton, rounding first, saw that at the time he could speed up, take second, and he did, and he slid in, and then he got hurt. So that only took... That's our seventh game of the year, folks. I hope you enjoyed your Byron Buxton season.
At least they're winning, though.
Are they?
6-1.
Oh, there? Oh,
yeah,
God.
Yeah. They scored a bunch of runs.
Last time I checked, they were 2-4. I'm like, they're winning. What are you talking about? Oh, what inning are they in?
Bottom of the eighth.
Oh, plenty of time for them to lose that game. Come on, man. What are you talking about?
Well, they don't have your favorite closer from last year.
Column A?
Oh, yeah, Column A.
Like I said, I don't want Column A. I'll take Column B. There you go. No, Column A, where is he at pitching now?
Thankfully not here.
Is he pitching? I don't know.
Who would want him after
I don't know. Well, in this day and age, someone picked him up.
Well, they'll say, well, if he throws 100 miles an
hour. If he goes back to his former glory, that's what they'll say. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's right up the Twins' alley, though, of signing players who are trying to reclaim their former glory.
Oh, gosh, it'd be like if the Easter Bunny every year, hop, hop, hop. Oh, he's down! He's down! Easter Bunny crashed into the wall. He's not getting up. He'll be back by July, kids. See if you can find the exit he put out there.
I know in high school baseball they do courtesy runners. They kind of need that for Byron Buxton when he's out there on the base.
I don't know what it is. I mean, okay, remember he leaned into an inside pitch and he broke his freaking thumb because the ball hit him in the hand. And then, of course, I'll never forget him at first base last year. He's like, it's okay. I don't need to come on out. You broke your finger because you leaned into an inside pitch because you had to be tough guy like you were a 12-year-old on a little league field, for goodness sakes. I mean, he's hurt himself multiple times running into the outfield wall.
Those are the ones that really annoy me. It's like, play the game smart. I mean, I know those are great catches, but and choose your places where it's the right time to do that.
Slow it down, Bump Bailey. All right, yeah. Slow it down. Just you don't have to go through the wall every time, okay? They put a warning track. It's called a warning track out there, for goodness sakes. It's your warning. Hey, guess what's coming next? It's not grass anymore. That means you got about 3 steps. Bang. Okay, down you go. It's just sadly predictable. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's just sadly predictable. But yeah, here we are. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. By the way, joining us 8B here at 435. Eric, it's another Eric with an A. It might be Eric. Eric or Eric. I'll have to figure this out. Eric Forsman. He's running up in Duluth. That's the new 8B, because 8B used to be Mary Franson. And I said, no, he's not. He's up in Duluth, isn't he? And so I looked at the new map, and yes, he's over. It's the east side of Duluth, so you're running up the North Shore. That's where he's running right now. And so he is going to be Democrat of the Day coming up at 4:35. We'll get a chat with him. You've got – who do you got coming up in the five?
Yeah, we have Walker Orenstein of MinnPost. Yes. MinnPost put out, I find, a really helpful guide on who's running in all 201 legislative races.
Did they finally? That's one of the best things they do.
Yeah, and what's really cool about this thing, too, they put the district numbers and then what region of the state it's in. So, I mean, oftentimes you can look at these numbers and say, 73A, well, what does that mean? So it's we're talking about that.
73, there is no 73A in Minnesota.
Well, no wonder I was getting confused then.
He's running in 149D. What? Who is that? No, that's not right.
I heard that's a strong district.
Yeah, it is.
Green Party, yeah. 149A, yeah, yeah.
Boston catching up at 6-2 now.
Uh-oh. Alame maybe's in there.
Oh, another long year. Another long story. At least it's nice to go out and watch a game at a baseball park. You know what I mean? I'm actually going to go catch a few Gopher games when it gets in May here. I'm going to go do that.
Oh, I've heard the Siebert Field is very underrated since they renovated that a few years
ago.
It's
nice. That's a nice baseball park.
I mean, that place was falling apart for a while until they renovated it.
It was like a bad rookie league team, man. East Coast rookie league team just falling apart because the moisture was causing the wood to rot constantly.
Didn't they even say, like, the golfers, you can't even play there this one season because the park was in such poor shape?
No, they I think they fixed it in time. They gave them a warning, but yeah. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Now, we have affectionately called Dr. Scott Jensen the witch doctor. Because we don't know which kind of doctor he is. Is he like the regular doctor who basically cares for the patients, tries to give them treatments, to all that good stuff? Or is he the doctor that says, give him ivermectin, that's a horse dewormer, that might work. I don't know. Which doctor will show up? We'd have no idea. Now, you got to remember, Scott Jensen, Dr. Scott Jensen, Dr. Scott Jensen, Jensen was the Republican behind the insulin bill. And remember, the rest of the Republican Party forced him to vote against it so that they could kill the bill, even though, because he was the tie-breaking vote. He would have been the vote to pass it. And they forced him, and it's all, and it was, I remember that vote. I don't know if you remember. The Republicans were coming up, come on, man, be tough, be tough. And this was like his bill. I mean, at one point, the guy had the betterment of Minnesotans' health in mind. Not so much anymore, it doesn't seem. At least it doesn't seem that way. Dr. Scott Jensen's latest piece of evidence for his erroneous claims that COVID-19 death counts have been inflated. Many people who died of COVID-19 would have died in 2 or 3 years anyway. Now, the first thing I thought of when I read that is, was he planning on killing them? Was he going to go on a murder spree or something like that? It's a lot of people to kill, man. You got to pick up a hobby, you know. You could build a ship in a bottle, or pickleball. You got a lot of things you can pick up. You don't have to go slaughter 10,000 Minnesotans. I don't think that's a good idea, sir. But no, I digress. See if you can follow this bouncing ball of delightful logic. Jensen, a practicing family physician. Former state senator from Chaska and GOP gubernatorial front runner argued during a Facebook live stream on Monday that Minnesota's COVID-19 death rate data is skewed, supporting his view that stay-at-home orders early in the pandemic were unnecessary. One reason the statistics are slanted, Jensen said, is that they included people who had severe health conditions in addition to COVID-19, like heart disease or high blood pressure. If you take John Doe, he's 75 years old. He has a fragile diabetes or emphysema. If he gets COVID-19, yes, COVID-19 could take his life. But based on actuarial studies, his lifespan might have only been 2 or 3 more years. That's why things are skewed. Okay. First of all, that bedside manner needs a little touching up there, okay, Witch Dr. Jensen? Okay. just to let you know, I've gone over your chart, and you're going to die anyway in 3 years, so what does it matter you got? Seriously.
That's some pretty dark logic.
Does he come in like a goth rock band, you know, just like dark lights and smoke? Hello there, I'm Dr. Jensen. Let me give you the positive news. Oh, God, I can't wait for the general election, and I've got so many impressions of him I got to do yet. All right. And, of course, here's Matt Burke. There you go. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to go all year long. Hello there. I'm your happy doctor, Dr. Jensen. And here's my running mate, Matt Burke. There we go. There we go. Who's creeping slowly towards the crypt? It's you. Sweet Lord, man. God, just like Little House on the Prairie with that doctor, you know? So let me back up here. Let me kind of go overview if we can. Jensen's argument is that since people were going to die anyway, why are you counting them for the count of 19? Now, the only way Jensen's argument makes any sense is if there are people who live forever, but no one lives forever. You live in infamy for a little bit, but you're dead. I mean, they all go. We all will. We got one trip around on this spinning rock. Eventually it ends. Your argument would be like, you know, I could take care of your cancer, but you're eventually going to die anyway. So, you know, you didn't die of cancer. You died of just age. I'm 42. You see? And you're complaining. It's Dr. Shiny Object. I'm going to enjoy that. I am going to enjoy that way too much. Doc, okay? If I can call you that, can I call him Doc? Maybe with a question mark, Doc? Doc, what are you smoking, dude? They were going to die anyway. He says, this is the bull crud they've got to spew to make the argument that the coronavirus pandemic really wasn't as bad as it was. Because you see, what's the COVID death count now? I got it here in the earlier parts. 12,465. That is how many people have died. So the only way that they can basically downplay that number is to basically say, well, 8,000 of those people were just, they were on death's door anyway, and just COVID got them at the very end. So you can't count that. They had gout. Oh my God. Don't be a blame on COVID. Oh my God. Seriously, what is wrong with you? They died of COVID. End of story. They would still, many of them would still be alive. And even in your argument of 2 to 3 years, they would still be alive today, doctor, if not for COVID. And I guarantee you there's a hell of a lot of family members out there that would be slightly happy to have a few more years with grandma or grandpa, as opposed to them dying of COVID. You are, all you're doing is you've convinced yourself of the Republican narrative, and so now comes the stupidity and moronicity of you spewing your ignorance to try to validate that argument. And it makes no sense, because the only way your argument makes any sense, Doc, is if you basically live forever. Because then a pre-existing condition that would take them out in 2 to 3 years might be a little more relevant. But considering everyone does die, that would be like saying, we're not going to treat your cancer because you're eventually going to die of something. Early in the pandemic, this doctor called COVID-19 a mild 4-day respiratory illness, which poses little risk to more than 95% of the people. The state population of Minnesota is 4.7 million. I believe the number of cases in Minnesota is 1 million. Well, it's time for Matt's Math Corner. God, I hate having to do this. Let's see here. Matt's Math Corner. So it'd be 1,437,638 divided by 5,700,000 people equals, 25% of the population. So when he sits there and he says, that 95% of the people, there's little risk to them, he's lying, because just on the number of people who have been sick compared to the number of people that live in Minnesota, 25% of the population of Minnesota got sick, which is not 5%. I know, pesky numbers, right, Doc? He's also accused healthcare providers of inflating their COVID numbers to get more money from the government. Once vaccination began, he questioned their safety despite overwhelming evidence of to the contrary. Jensen opened the Monday video by explaining that the Christian Holy Week, maybe that's why so many people, whenever they hear Scott Jensen, go, sweet Jesus. Leading up to Easter prompted him to reflect, especially on government responses to COVID-19. It's Easter. You know what that means. Talking about Biden's border policy. What are you doing, man? Okay. Hey, Dr. Jensen, if you want to go the Christian route, Gospel of Matthew, great book. By the way, you do or don't do whatever it is you do or don't want to do. I'm a Christian. Gospel of Matthew, great book. Jesus' teachings on earth. That's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the four gospels of the Bible. They tell the story of Jesus. And Jesus, the man that makes all Christians Christians, he basically said, take care of people. He was very much pro-vaccine. He was very much pro-mask. He was very much pro-life. Not so much ivermectin. I don't think he was. So, needless to say, if you're going to reflect on Holy Week, think about the holy, ungodly, anti-Christian medical advice you seem to spew, sir, if I may. If I may. My Lord. Because Jesus would be pro-vaccine. Jesus would be pro-vaccine. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. More on this when we do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. By the way, thank you, Brett, and thank you to
Drinking the Style
the Drinking the Style crew thing filling in. That was kind of a last second thing. I appreciate that very much.
We had some fun, though. Yeah.
Gregory Rich. And how'd you guys clean up the studio so quick? No, I just...
Oh, we were here till about 10 o'clock last night, deep cleaning.
I'm surprised. That 10, you say? Wow, that was early.
Zero res out here to clean the carpets.
Nicely done.
Yeah.
Gregory, thank you very much. All the crew over there. And thank you, Brett, as well. I do appreciate that. Jensen basically says more than 97% of Minnesotans who died of COVID in 2020 and 2021 had another health condition as well. Referring to an analysis by a retired lawyer that was published in a conservative news site. The comorbidity of a associated illness is not a hangnail, Jensen said. It's a big time stuff. It's obesity to an alarming degree. It's hypertension. It's coronary artery disease. It's diabetes. It's fragile pulmonary disease. It's stuff that could curtail your lifetime. Could. Obesity is not a death sentence necessarily. Hypertension is not a death sentence, necessarily. The argument he has to make is these people, his Christian, this is the argument he says is the Christian argument. These people would have just died anyway of all these other diseases, so to count COVID is irrelevant. That is some crazy train, man. That is unbelievable. There is no guarantee any of these people would have died from that. And let's just say, Dr. Jensen, if I can be honest, let's say someone had coronary artery disease, but then got cancer, and cancer killed them. Would you say the cancer didn't kill them? It was the coronary artery disease. No, you'd say the cancer killed them. So this entire argument is fraudulent, especially for a medical professional. You don't have someone get hit by a semi out in the highway and say, well, they died of cancer. No, they died of the car that hit them. Unbelievable. Claims of inflated COVID-19 mortality counts have been common and baseless talking points among right-wing pundits and COVID-19 skeptics since at least August of 2020, according to a nonprofit media institute, Poynter. People making the argument often allege that deaths are overcounted by including people who died with, not from, COVID-19, which has been debunked. In reality, COVID-19 deaths are likely undercounted, studies have shown, as well. I can't wait for Dr. Scott Jensen, because I still do think that him and Og are going to be the Republican ticket for the governor's race this year. Yes, I just did refer to Matt Burke as Og. So I think Jensen and Og are going to be the gubernatorial candidates. So I can't wait for him to say, where did you get the idea? I said everyone was going to die of something else anyway. I'm a doctor. Can you just look for it? Look for the ad where he's out there and he's looking in the camera going, I don't know where you get the idea. I'm crazy. I'm not. I'm a doctor. I'm just concerned about people's health. And I believe people should be able to get the health treatment they want. Well, unless it's about, you know, a woman's choice. No, then they can't have that. No, not that. But everything else, I'm for choice. Quinn Nystrom, friend of the show, author of Diabetes Advocate, who ran for Congress as a Democrat in 2020, said Jensen's statements were appalling and contributed to the stigma around diabetes, which many people erroneously believe is a direct result of weight, diet, or exercise habits. It's not. I've got a friend, their child, very athletic kid. He's got diabetes. It's a disease. The whole undercurrent is that people with diabetes, it's their fault. That we shouldn't be counted. To me, the irony is you have a candidate who on his main platform is pro-life. It doesn't feel like certain lives matter. No, and that's the thing is, and Quinn, nice job pointing that out. All these people die. They didn't die. He's not sad for him. His main goal is to dismiss these deaths and act like they were going to die anyway. That's your Christian compassion. And that jackass had the audacity to bring Jesus into his argument. Wow. Dude, you need to get your butt to church and actually read that book you claim to represent, because you're nowhere near, sir. You are nowhere near. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. A Gospel of Matthew, you say? Really? Where's that? Exactly. Democrat of the day, Eric Forbesman, going to be joining us here in just a moment, talking about his race up in Duluth. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.
Billboard, baby, do a leap and make them dance when they come on. Everybody looking for a dance floor to run on.
If you want to run away with me, I know a galaxy and I could take you for a ride.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Democrat of the day, we head up to 8B, actually the new 8B, because the old 8B was Mary Franson's seat. And I was like, what? No, 8B now is basically East Duluth running up the North Shore. Eric Forsman is kind enough to join us right now. He is the Democrat who is running for that seat and kind enough to talk about his campaign. Hey, Eric, how are you?
Great, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much for the time. And by the way, I love your town. I do love going up there. I hope you guys didn't get too much snow this last time around.
Yeah, it's easy to love Duluth, and appreciate you having me today. It has not been a typical April, and we're just trying to get to the beautiful summer that everybody wants to come north for, and we're looking forward to that whenever it gets here.
Talk a little bit about your background first. Who exactly is Eric Forsman?
Yeah, great question. So, Matt, I moved to Duluth in 2006. I came to the University of Minnesota Duluth, go Bulldogs, big hockey fan. But my wife, Jessica, and I fell in love with this city like so many do who come in and visit, and we stayed here. So we've been here for about 16, 17 years now. I'm the current president of the Duluth City Council. I've been serving on the council since 2018, and I also work in economic development throughout really what is the 8th Congressional District, and I'm excited to be able to bring some of my experience and talents to the legislature next year, hopefully.
You'll be very happy to know my oldest daughter is actually her number one choice right now as UMD.
Well, let me know what I need to do to close that deal. We want her up here.
Well, it's a great...
We need more good students and young professionals in Duluth, that's for sure.
It's a great school. It is a great town. Let's talk about, okay, so you moved there. What prompted you eventually to move work on city council, get involved there?
Yeah, so I have always had a passion for service. I grew up on the Iron Range, Matt, and you know, I grew up in a town that, quite frankly, had seen its best days, and that's how the people felt. And it's gotten better since then, but that always instilled a passion for service within my heart. So when I got to town, I started to make connections and just started doing a lot of volunteering. So I've served on over 15 boards and commissions, task forces, you pretty much name it. I have a board addiction here in town, but it's really given me a great lens into what the community's needs are and just given me a chance to connect with all of the amazing people who are doing terrific things within our community. And then eventually, when an opening came about on the city council, one of the city councilors who stepped down asked me to apply for that seat, and I said no. And here we are, 4 years later, and now I'm the council president. She got me to change my mind.
Well, and I, by the way, I love that path, and I've talked about this too. I was on planning and zoning in Hopkins, the city of Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And you get involved. It is a fantastic way to get your toes into a little bit of local politics and helping out, because you deal with its parks, your water board, whatever it can be, school boards. You get involved in these things, and it gives you a good view of it. And like yourself, there are some people that get there and realize, okay, this is good. I want to do this more often, and it's a great way to find out if you've got the heart for politics, which clearly you do.
Yeah, you're right. I think local elected officials end up dealing with the problems that either fall through the cracks that aren't getting addressed by the state or the federal levels. And they also just deal with the day-to-day stuff that people really care about. They want to have good roads. They want to have infrastructure that works. They want to have great schools. But things like some of the issues we're struggling with right now around making sure our homeless populations are taken care of, those things fall through, and the city and the county and the school districts have to step up and solve those. So I think that's a great perspective, and I'm really supportive of whenever somebody who is an elected official at the local level decides that they want to look at another ground up.
So were you making the plans to run for this seat prior to the redistricting, or was it something about the redistricting you said, you know what, I want to represent that area?
Yeah, no, actually it was a huge surprise. So Representative Jen Schultz, who has served us for 8 years in East Duluth, it was a surprise that she didn't decide to seek reelection. As you likely know, she is running now to challenge Pete Stauber for the 8th Congressional District, which is very exciting. But we were all kind of caught off guard. And so that was something where I had to talk with my family and my supporters to see, is that something that they think I should do and aspire to? And it certainly wasn't in the goal plan for this year, but I just think I've got a skill set that really would be beneficial and am excited to be moving forward in the election this year.
And we should describe them, I mean, because all these are brand new districts. I think I kind of tagged it there. It's the east side of Duluth as you run up the North Shore, correct?
Correct. And it's not Alexandria, because I put that I was running for AB and I had a bunch of people email me like, are you moving? I said, no, it's just redistricting. So it's the eastern tip of Duluth up until you get about to St. Luke's Hospital.
So let's talk a little bit about what you'd want to accomplish. You get to St. Paul. What do you want to help out with in 8B?
Yeah, so there's a lot of needs, and I see a lot of needs as a city councilor. But actually, my number one priority is education. My wife is a high school counselor here in town. From what I've heard from her and the teacher she works with, they've never seen as many needs in the classroom right now. And I know I've seen the Great Education Minnesota tweets about how much money the the House and Senate proposals are going to give to our schools, and it's a big fat zero from the Senate right now. But truthfully, I mean, there are so many needs that these kids have right now coming out of COVID. And so anything I can do to provide more mental health resources, especially, and more counselors, more psychologists, all those things. But we have to be able to find a path forward to get those things done. But education's my top one. The other thing I hear a lot about, especially as a counselor, is access to things like affordable housing. As you know, the real estate prices are just out of control right now across the state. And the rents that we're seeing go up are just right there with them. So access to more affordable housing, which comes through state and federal funding primarily, access to better quality health care. Child care has been a big one for me. That's another barrier to growth that we're experiencing, and something that I've really devoted a lot of time and energy to. And then I can't leave climate change out of the equation, because we just have to keep making progress there. But I'm somebody who I've worked on everything from the Memorial Day parade to pretty much you name it here in town, whether it's Spirit Mountain or other issues. So I like to get involved and put my fingerprints on everything I can, quite frankly.
Down here in the Twin Cities, if you don't mind me touching a little bit more on the housing issue up there, because we do get, we get the story here, but we always get a very Twin Cities centric version of it. Talk a little bit about that up in Duluth, because I'm, you know, it is something that everywhere right now, the housing market, there's just not a lot of inventory, prices are going up, and there's just not a lot of opportunity anywhere.
Yeah, I was just in the cities visiting a friend of mine who's going through the miserable experience of trying to buy a house. And these are people that have good jobs, no kids, and have the time to go try to tour and do the whole offer song and dance, and they can't even get something. Well, it's the same here. We have the same market in Duluth. It's people are offering tens of thousands of dollars above asking price, no inspection, sight unseen. And then those are folks who have the means to be able to look and buy their first home or their second home. So somebody who is trying to rent and just trying to get by, what we've been doing is trying to put as much of the federal resources that we've been getting as a city toward development of new housing. But that takes years to come online. So we put 19 out of the $58 million that the federal government gave us here in Duluth to build more affordable housing. We're going to build 400 units, but it's probably going to take 2 or 3 years for that to happen. So folks are just really having a hard time all across the board, from folks who have the ability to buy a house to those just trying to get by and find a decent place to rent.
And I know that Duluth is actually one of the hotter markets right now. A lot of people wanting to move into Duluth, and that doesn't help either. I mean, it's a great problem to have. A lot of people want to move into your town, but once again, it compounds the problem.
Yeah, that's right. Because I think COVID changed the game. I think a lot of folks are saying, well, hey, if I can take my job with me, or maybe I can work a couple of days a week from the office, why wouldn't I want to live in Duluth? Which is great, but we also have to have the housing and the childcare to support that. And those are tricky issues right now, but we've been getting after it.
Two of your endorsements, the DFL Veterans Caucus, also the Native People's Caucus of the Minnesota DFL. Let's start with Native issues. Obviously, and I'm going to repeat a line from Native Roots Radio, which is on the show on after me. Native issues are human issues, and human issues are Native issues. I think it's a great line. Talk a little bit about addressing the needs of the Native American community.
Yeah, it's been something that I've really had a pleasure to work on here in town. And actually, our past council president, Renee Van Nett, is the first Indigenous counselor in the city of Duluth's history. And one of the things that we worked on together was recognizing some of the tragic history that the state has around boarding schools and bringing some attention to that over the past year. I've had a chance to get to know our folks in town who are of Native American heritage and some of the issues that are challenging them. I've also been it's been my honor to get to know some of the things that our tribal nations are working on. And as a state legislator, I would really look forward to being able to partner with them on all sorts of issues down at the state capitol that affect them.
I'm a veteran, U.S. Army. I know. It was the U.S. Army. So talk about, obviously, veterans issues. I mean, it's not something that's getting a lot of spotlight right now. So I'll let you have a spotlight. What are some of the veterans issues that you're concerning yourself with right now?
Yeah, no, I'm not a veteran, so thank you for your service. But there's a couple of localized things here in town that I wanted to touch on. We've got our 148th Fighter Wing here in town. It's well known, it's well respected. Right now, there's some state funding that we're trying to get after to really secure the future of that facility as the federal government looks at their decisions for where they're going to make investments or where they're going to not make investments into the future. We have 300 airmen and women who are deployed overseas right now. And so we've been working to advocate for them and make sure that we keep our eighth largest employer. They have over 1,100 jobs up at the base. But beyond that, this is a tough time to be a veteran. We've got a lot of mental health challenges. The local veterans here in town tell me about how events like what's happening in Ukraine or even what happened in Afghanistan last year are triggering. And it brings up some of the PTSD issues that we haven't done enough to get after. There's an issue with a veterans home in the cities that is in need of repair that I think the bonding bill could help address. But really just being able to partner with them and also as a Democrat, show appreciation for our veterans community, especially after what we've seen with the National Guard being activated these last couple of years more than ever before, and make sure that we are a party that we're right on the issues. I think we're providing the help that they need, but let's also just make sure that we're showing our appreciation too.
Looking at your district, it's hard to not notice the large body of water that you have next to it. Let's talk about, you brought up environmental issues. Let's talk about clean water, because obviously we've gone through the time in my life. We had problems with pollution. They cleaned it up. But now we have a Republican Party that seems to be very intent on polluting things again. Let's talk about keeping Lake Superior and northern Minnesotans' waters clean.
Yeah, Lake Superior is a treasure. And there's a lot of things we can do. One of the topics actually that we've been trying to address recently is some of the lead pipe issues that we have in town, which is not just an issue for Lake Superior, but it's an issue for human health. We've got an older city that's 26 miles long and 5 miles wide. So there's a lot of things like that that we are trying to address. We put some of our federal resources toward that. There's been a lot of effort over the past couple of decades to clean up the St. Louis River, which feeds into Lake Superior.
Yeah.
And then we've got our friends on Park Point. If you're familiar, once you get past the lift bridge and you go down to Park Point in Duluth, who have been dealing with a lot of erosion challenges over the last couple of years. And that could be based on climate change. That could be based on some other factors, too. But there's some real concern about what that's going to entail for them into the future. And so all of those things are important for us to prioritize and address and also work with not just our state government, but the governments throughout the Great Lakes to make sure that our lakes are staying clean and healthy.
My grandparents used to live out there on that spit of land, and it's kind of one of those things where it seemed to be, you know, we went through a lot. I mean, it's funny. You go back and you look at old photos of that area where it was basically wetlands and stuff, and we cleaned that up, but yet we still have that erosion problem. And when you try to tell people, oh, we have erosion problems on a lake, That for some reason, you know, it's like with everything with a lot of Republicans, they kind of just roll their eyes about environmental issues because they just don't see it unless it affects their own property. And that's something you've really got, not just there, the entire lakefront there, you know, that's a big lake that does some damage when it gets angry. So you got to make sure you manage that correctly.
Yeah, I took some heat when I said that climate change was a city council issue when I ran. And over the last couple of years, all we've seen have been issues around erosion around our lakefront.
Yeah.
And to the point where it's threatening people's property, it's threatening people's homes, and we can't bury our head in the sand that's disappearing and not do something about it. So I think that the city was one of the first to declare a climate emergency as a municipality, and I was proud to be a co-sponsor on that. But really, we just have to continue to do more because the problem's not going to get any better. We have to put resources into it.
This is the easy part here because I can tell everyone that's listening right now, we need volunteers and donations to go up and help Eric up in Duluth. And here's the greatest part. If you go for a weekend of door knocking this summer, you're in Duluth. It's a lovely city. You can go door knocking for a few hours, go have some fun in town. That's absolutely the way to do it. Donations, volunteers needed throughout the entire election season. Eric, if people want to find out more information about your campaign and find out how they can volunteer or donate, how do they do that?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So it's an easy address, but I'm going to spell it because my name isn't so easy to spell. So it's ericforsman.com, but it's A-R-I-K. F-O-R-S-M-A-N. So we would love to have you. I would love to host you for a door knock this summer. One of my, you know, my campaign treasurer happens to be the owner of one of our fine brewing establishments here in the city.
Hey.
And we'd be happy to go stop by afterward if you want to come up and enjoy it.
That sounds fantastic. I'll link to all this a little bit later on. Congratulations on the decision to run. I think that you'll do a lot of good there in Duluth in 8B. So hopefully we'll see you in St. Paul. Eric Forsman, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Matt, it was a pleasure. I appreciate it.
Democrat of the day, Eric Forsman, 8B, the east side, north shore of Duluth. Get up there, help him out. Let's take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. God, that was a solid interview, Matt. Good district, too, man. That's a lot of fun. The campaign manager runs a brewery.
Going from Mary Franzen's district now to that.
God, I mean, 8B's got to just, the number 8 and the letter B have just got to be just delighted. Oh my God, thank God. And I got a view of the lake. I'm not with crazy Train McCoy over there. 952. Crazy Train McCoy. All right, write that one down. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Since I got a few minutes here, let's do the Minnesota coronavirus update. I kind of alluded to it earlier with the which doctor is it? Is it Dr. Jensen doctor or Dr. Jensen? Oh, Republican talking points first. Donnie, Dr. Gloom. We talked a little bit about the coronavirus update, but let's get into the main update for today. Friday's COVID-19 numbers from the Department of Health. 877 newly reported cases. What the hell? 877? That number's up dramatically. And that's a one-day number. 877 newly reported cases, or 7 newly reported deaths, or as Dr. Jensen, I'm going to guess, would say, is they were in a good diagnosed with something else anyway. Why are you calling it COVID? I don't know why. Because they're come down with COVID. Maybe that's what it is. I don't know. The state's COVID-19 death toll, as I mentioned earlier, is 12,465. With the 7 newly reported deaths involved there as well. Today's update includes case data reported to just in... Okay, so there it is. That's why it is. It's the 72-hour period ending at 4 a.m. on Thursday, April 14th. So they must not have had an update yesterday. So there you go. So it's larger, not because of a one-day thing. Thank God. Ugh, coronavirus variant that is currently dominant in Minnesota is the BA2 version of Omicron. According to the latest Metropolitan Council wastewater data, once again, they're hiring. 96% of samples in the wastewater of the 7-county metro area, delicious, are BA2. The remaining 4% are the original BA1. So BA2 now is clearly the dominant strain. Through April 14th, the number of people with COVID-19 hospitalized in Minnesota is 205. That's up from 193 reported on April 13th. Of those hospitalized, 25 people are in intensive care, down from 32, 180 are in non-ICU care. That's up from 161. As of April 13th, the state reported that 3,901,329 people have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. 3,692,661 people have completed the vaccine series. And there are 2,552,309 Minnesotans who have got their first booster shot. Once again, the total amount of people in Minnesota who have gotten sick from COVID, 1,437,638, or as Dr. Jensen might imply, well, they were going to get sick with something else anyway at some point. So why are you counting COVID? Huh? Thanks, Og. Starting Monday, Minneapolis students will no longer have to wear masks at school or on buses, the school district said on Thursday as it announced changes to the COVID-19 protocols. The news came 2 days after St. Paul's school board voted 6-1 to change the mask policy for that district, removing the mandate and allowing students and faculty to choose whether or not to wear a face covering in school buildings. Besides dropping its mask mandate, Minneapolis Public Schools will discontinue universal contract tracing. Officials said that means families may not be notified if someone in their student's class tests positive for COVID-19, which is getting pretty slim at this point, it sounds like. District officials also said that the beginning on Monday, fully vaccinated students and staff will no longer be required to isolate after COVID-19 exposure, and that the quarantine time for an unvaccinated students and adults in the schools will drop from 10 days down to 5 days. However, it said the quarantine period for those who test positive for COVID-19 will remain at 10 days. COVID public school, Minneapolis public schools will continue to meet regularly for the COVID-19 regional support team. The protocol updates in response to the city's declining COVID-19 rates. Yet again, though, the U.S. is trudging into what could be another COVID-19 surge as cases rising nationally in most states after a two-month decline. One big unknown, we don't know how high that mountain's going to grow, said Dr. Stuart Campbell-Ray, an infectious disease expert at Johns Hopkins University. No one expects a peak nearly as high as the last one, with a contagious Omicron version of the coronavirus ripped through the population. But experts warn that the coming wave caused by a mutant called BA2, that's thought to be about 30% more contagious, will wash across the nation. So if you haven't gotten it yet, and you didn't get Omicron, the original Omicron, if this is 30% more contagious, and you're not vaccinated and you're not boosted, my guess is you're going to have a decent chance of getting it. They worry that hospitalizations, which are already starting to tick up in some parts of the Northeast, will rise in a growing number of states in the coming weeks, and the case wave will be bigger than it looks, they say, because reported numbers are vast undercounts as more people test at home without reporting their infections or skipping testing altogether. At the height of the previous Omicron surge, reported daily cases reached into the hundreds of thousands. As of Thursday, the seven-day rolling average for daily new cases nationally rose to 39,521, up from 30,724 2 weeks earlier. So definitely things are getting a little bit worse there. Keeping the surge somewhat in check, experts say, is a high level of immunity in the U.S. from vaccination or past infection compared with the early winter. So, and that was kind of the deal. And that's something that Dr. Joe Eastman, when we've had him on, the modeling expert, has said, is that so many people got the original Omicron that there still is a lot of natural immunity there, but 30% more contagious. You know, I know there are some, there's some rado loon balls out there that like to say, it's over, it's over. No, get vaccinated, get vaccinated, get boosted, wear a mask, and trust me, then it might be over. Hopefully, hopefully, hopefully before too much longer. Hour two, coming up next. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show, 5:05 on your Friday. Matt, Brett, the Twins did win, although they did, of course, we were up 6-1. We ended up winning 8-4 because, yeah, them. And Buxton is out now for a while. He walked off on his own accord, though. It wasn't, but still.
The Strib said it's a sore knee, but knees are always tough, though.
There's nothing in the knee that matters, is there?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Especially if you're a speedy outfielder. You don't need your knees.
Yeah, knees are fine, man. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. All right, so I've got a litany of stories I have wanted to talk about this week, national stories that are just hilarious because they are giving Republicans chest pains, and I love that. First story. Did you see that what the Governor Abbott of Texas was doing on the border with the truck inspections?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He was going, I'm going to stop all traffickers. And there was a point, there are truckers who are making the point that the truckers themselves, not exactly the most liberal group of voters, were furious with him because it seems like what he was single-handedly trying to do was stop the supply chain issues. And people are saying what should take 20 seconds to get through at the border as a truck driver because of these deals that they've got down there was taking 4 to 5 days. What really ended up coming back and biting him, though, was most of the groceries and fruit and vegetables from Mexico that Texas sells on their grocery stores comes through their own border. And so apparently grocery stores in Texas were starting to look pretty darn slim. And when Abbott and his crew tried to argue that was the Biden people, everyone said, no, it's you. And the truckers came out and basically went after him. So now he's opened it up. And by the way, how many people did he find? He found no traffickers, none in any of the trucks. He was just slowing it down to try to make the supply chain worse. What a jerk. What a just an absolute jerk. But there you go. And his own state is starting to turn on him. Good luck in the governor's race there. I also wanted to mention, you know, the Let's Go Brandon cryptocurrency. I feel dirty just saying that, man.
It's a cryptocurrency.
It's a cryptocurrency. Well, that was one. These were the guys that wanted to put that on the NASCAR car. And,
oh, right.
Because that's where Let's Go Brandon came from. They were chanting blank Joe Biden because Christians. And the host of the NASCAR show says, I think they're saying Let's Go Brandon. And so that's the conservatives got giddy because I can swear at the president by just saying this from the same people that brought you the white power OK sign. They're giddy with joy. Well, someone decided to slap one of those on a cryptocurrency, which I don't know if you can slap on a crypto. It's just a made up thing. And this is the cryptocurrency where they gave Trump like $50 billion, which is like worth $35,000 or something like that. I mean, it was like rubles at this point. You know, it's like, here, ruble, here, 4 million ruble. What does that get me? Half a Twinkie. It's not really worth anything. Apparently, it's an absolute utter disaster, even in cryptocurrency standards, that the Let's Go Brandon cryptocurrency is so bad that there's lawsuits starting ahoy to try to basically, you know, people trying to recoup their investment into what they said was a sure thing. Sure. Okay. You guys on the Republican side that like to just send your money to Republicans, you guys are dupes, man. The reason why you're poor is not because of Joe Biden. It's because as you complain about Joe Biden, you buy $3,000 worth of cryptocurrency that's marketed as Trump cryptocurrency, or you go out there and buy 50 flags or those quirky little stickers you keep putting on gas, vandalizing gas pumps with. It's your own dang fault. I have no money, Joe Biden. Oh, good. Amazon's here.
50 more Trump flags.
There you go, 50. I'm really showing my support. Finally, there's two stories that came at the Hunter Biden, you know, thing. Because once again, Republicans are rage aroused at the idea of going and getting Hunter Biden. We got him. Because once again, a laptop that was in a Delaware repair store that apparently they didn't call the owner of, they just decided to search themselves, has all the evidence, which no one else seems to be able to find anything that corroborates with it. The guy that owns the store, who's this right-wing stooge, has said, and by the way, this is the end of the laptop because there's no way in hell this thing is ever going to see a courtroom, even if you do find evidence against him. He has said numerous people have tried to put stuff on that laptop. Like, and they keep implying that there are inappropriate pictures of children on there. And that's not on there. But he has said people are trying to place, you know, disinformation on that laptop. So, you know, it's kind of one of those things where it's kind of goofy on that. But the other thing is this, is that as much as they want, the argument they say is that this proves that Hunter Biden was working with the Ukrainians and making a lot of money. But the thing which I find to be fascinating is the same people, when you bring up Jared Kushner and his sweetheart deals that he gets from the Saudis, which was at $2 billion? You know, if we're going to investigate that, shouldn't we investigate Saudi Arabia basically giving Trump's son-in-law $2 billion or any of the other foreign deals his kids seem to have gotten? Shouldn't we give any of them any kind of investigation? And so the fact that broke, what Republicans are doing now is they got their rage erections that are, they're so angry, but they have to wait for a few weeks because they know the media will forget all about Jared Kushner and they'll come back to go after Hunter Biden. So 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Dennis, well, really quick here, because we have to get into the interview here with Walker. Let's Dennis and Fridley, welcome on in, Dennis.
Hi. I was listening to your show in the first hour.
Yes, sir.
I really like the way you went after Scott Jensen with his comments about people would have died from something else anyway, so you can't count them as COVID deaths. Okay? What do we have to do to get Democrats to stand up and talk the way you talk? That's plain common sense. You don't even have to get into facts. And you get people like...
Well, I'm into facts. No, trust me. I'm big time into the facts. But, yeah, okay. I get what you're saying.
That particular issue, okay? I am so tired of Democrats hiring what I perceive to be Republican ad agencies to do their ads. I want Democrats to stand up and fight and go after them the way you do and the way Tom Hartman does and a few other people. How do we get Democrats to do that?
Dennis, first of all, thank you very much. Very nice words. I appreciate the phone call today. I'll tell you what. Hold on. Let's get to Brett's interview here in just a second. Hold on. I will come back. I've got a little thing, a little song and dance. Well, not actually a song and dance. We're saving that for Easter Parade at the end of the show. But I got a little rant I'm going to go on here in the back half hour here. But once again, Brett, you are talking to our good friends over at MinnPost.
Yeah, Walker Orenstein today talking about their list of candidates running for the state legislature. And then we're also going to be talking about clean car standards in Minnesota and making sure we get off carbon and how that's going to be playing out of the state legislature. So that's what we got ahead.
All right. It is Walker Orenstein with MinnPost with Brett right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's Brett Johnson with you here on a Friday afternoon. And our Friday interview today is with Walker Orenstein, who reports on the state legislature for MinnPost. As today we're going to be talking about two articles that Walker recently wrote. One has to do with fuel standards in Minnesota. And one is, well, part of a team that Walker was a part of that has developed a list of who is running in each of Minnesota's 201 legislative races. So we'll be chatting about that a little bit later on. Walker, thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So let's start off talking about gas prices, because the article you recently wrote this week is titled Why High Gas Prices May Doom the Chances of Minnesota Adopting Low Carbon Fuel Standards. So DFLers have been working on this policy for quite some time. I know we don't need to quite get too far into the weeds, but what exactly would this do, this proposal do for fuel suppliers in the state?
Yeah, so in its most basic form, it requires these fuel suppliers. So if you think about someone who supplies gasoline or ethanol, or even sort of an electric car supplier, energy supplier, it would make them just make their product cleaner over time. The policy usually sets kind of a benchmark, you know, a baseline, and it says you need to be, you know, 25% cleaner than this 2018 baseline by 2030, and 75% cleaner by 2040, 100% cleaner by 2050. That's sort of the basics of it. And those are actually the benchmarks set in the latest Democratic proposal. And the idea is just sort of over time, you make fuel suppliers be cleaner in order to slash carbon emissions.
Interesting. And what I found also kind of fascinating about the idea is that there is an off ramp on this, where if fuel prices end up rising too much in the future, well, then the policy would be somewhat suspended for a while. Is that correct?
Yeah, I know that that's one option that House Democrats are looking for, that they've said that they recognize that gas prices, you know, soaring to a certain degree would not be great. And that wouldn't really necessarily prove that the program is functioning as they would envision. And so that they'd like to see that, you know, maybe an off-ramp sort of thing. So if things aren't really functioning as they wanted them to, they could, you know, exit the program or suspend it in some way, alter it in some way in order to sort of escape that possibility. But I haven't heard necessarily what that exact off-ramp would be at this point.
So if we do end up passing these carbon standards in the state, I understand we likely wouldn't feel the impact on gas prices, if there would be any impact, for quite some time, correct? Talk about that and why that might be the case.
It would take certainly a little bit of time. So, you know, there has been some complaints from Republicans about the potential for this to impact gas prices. And we can get into that, the specifics of that more, but... Mm-hmm. It wouldn't impact gas prices until the program is both A, up and running, and B, sort of, as it gets tougher over time, that's when it would have a greater and greater potential impact on gas prices. And so in its really early years, it probably wouldn't have much of an impact. And so if, say, the legislature were to pass it tomorrow, that would, in its current form, would direct the Walz administration to kind of fill in a lot of the details about the program, which includes sort of this complicated exchanging of credit based on whether or not you're meeting the benchmarks in the system. And so they need to fill in that detail. It would probably be a rulemaking process. Those can take months or a year or whatever it might be. And then as it's sort of implemented, the earlier years aren't so impactful. And so like in Oregon, I know in its earliest form, it was like, just a fraction of a cent in 2017 after the program really began in 2016. But in more recent years, that has ticked up a little bit. It's been, 3.7 cents, kind of an additional fuel cost in 2020, last year, 5 cents. So those aren't nothing. They're not enormous. However you want to categorize a five cent, increase on gasoline. But it is true that in its earliest kind of years, it would take a little while for this to really kick in on fuel prices, is how other states have experienced it, at least.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about Oregon, because Minnesota might be using that as a bit of a model for their carbon standards. Of course, three West Coast states have those carbon standards right now, Washington, Oregon, and California. But as I understand it, Minnesota lawmakers are really looking at Oregon as a model, being that they think that state is most similar to how Minnesota might look. So talk a little bit about Oregon's program and how Minnesota is sort of modeling it after them.
Right. So obviously California has this really big, complex economy. And so modeling Minnesota after them, or at least looking to them as what might we expect to experience, it doesn't necessarily provide the closest fit. Oregon makes sense because they're a few years into their program and there's a lot to learn from them. Washington State is still implementing the program. They passed their program really recently, so it hasn't even really started. And so there's not much to model after there. So Oregon has had this for a little while, right? So they can take a look at it. And basically what I know is, there's been a ton of policy work behind the scenes in the background to develop the Minnesota proposal. And it's been done by, legislators and also interest groups, advocacy groups. The Walz administration held like 30 meetings recently to try and hear feedback on a potential low carbon fuel standard, that sort of thing. And I know in particular the Walz administration and generally supporters of a fuel standard have said, we think that we're looking at what the impact in Oregon might be. And also they talked to Oregon, the Walz administration, quite a bit just to learn about some of the technical stuff, implementing the program, the specifics. They gave a special shout out in a report that they wrote. We worked closely with Oregon on this is basically what they said.
So as we take things back to Minnesota, you would naturally think that carbon standards would not be popular with Republicans. And while that is somewhat the case, there are some Republicans in the legislature who are warming up to the idea. So talk about what they find appealing about this idea of bringing these carbon standards to Minnesota and why it does appeal to some Republicans and even those in the ag industry.
Right. Yeah. A lot of Democratic proposals for climate change initiatives don't find a lot of support, if any, among Republicans. But the one kind of wrinkle here is that the low carbon fuel standard is generally thought to be a really good thing for biofuels. So that's your ethanol and your biodiesel. And later on down the road, potentially using that stuff for like a jet fuel or something like that. So that really draws a wider range of support. The American Biofuels Coalition supported an earlier version of this proposal in Minnesota. And one of the things they said was, value of biofuels in California has like quadrupled since the program started, and they're like thrilled about it, basically. So for that reason, people like Senator Dave Senjum, who's a Republican from Rochester, he chairs the Energy Committee, pretty influential over in the Senate, has said, if it's good for agriculture, we could be interested. He, in fact, it was interesting when I talked to him, he cloaked his interest in the program, though he has some caveats and some things he doesn't like, but he cloaked his interest in the program in right now sort of more traditional Republican phrases and talking points like energy independence. So that's like not being less reliant on foreign oil and stuff. And then the idea is, we're boosting ethanol and that is grown by farmers in the Midwest kind of thing. And the reason that it's helpful for farmers growing ethanol suppliers, biofuel suppliers, is because those products are already generally considered by the government, at least in these formulas, to be, to have fewer carbon emissions. And there's a lot of research and hot debate over the actual carbon emissions of, you know, wide-scale ethanol and those kinds of things. But generally, they're getting credits under this credit program. And generally, gasoline suppliers are having to buy credits. They're having deficits. And so for that reason, you know, it can be a really big boost to ethanol. And it still requires those fuels to get cleaner over time. But when these, you know, biofuels associations and growers, they look at something like the Clean Cars Rule, which was another Walz initiative, and that really in some ways focused on electric vehicles. You know, biofuels can see themselves in this proposal, right? You know, it involves us. It involves us getting cleaner over time. It's not just skipping over us and going right to electric vehicles. So I will say some environmental groups would prefer more of a focus on environment or on electric vehicles rather than on biofuels, as this policy does.
So at least in terms of the current legislation or the current session that we're in right now at the state legislature, is there any path forward for the legislation, or is it likely something that we're going to have to possibly implement in the future?
Likely implement in the future. Senator Senjum, who is really the key person on this because it would run through his committee, said he was going to basically have some behind-the-scenes talks with his other colleagues on this, but he said the potential impact to gas prices is one reason why they're not really interested in this year. He says it's not ready for prime time. He's also not really a big fan of the credit trading system that's sort of integral to the bill. He thinks it's overly complicated, and he says, you know, if you can't explain this to your sort of average Minnesotan, if they don't understand it, then we probably shouldn't do it. And I haven't really seen a version of this policy that doesn't have that credit trading system. So I don't really know necessarily how those two things are compatible, though potentially they could be. It's just not up to me. Maybe smarter people are going to figure that out. But so he's basically said not this session. And who knows whether that means next session is a possibility or 2 years or never or what. But he's interested in it. He sees it as a good idea in theory, but not really something for the near future. Though I will say that there's been, I would phrase it as the Walz administration has not totally closed the door on exploring doing this via rule, as in using existing anti-pollution law to implement this on their own, like they did with the Clean Cars Rule. And so I don't want to suggest that they are certainly going down that road or that they propose going down that road, but I will say they haven't said we don't have the ability to do this, and they haven't said, you know, we're totally shutting the door on that as a possibility. So that's one thing to keep an eye on, if that makes sense.
We can read more about that over at MinnPost.com, why high gas prices may doom the chances of Minnesota adopting low carbon fuel standards. Next piece I want to move on to has to do, well, with, I know you were a part of this group that was putting together a list of who is running in all of Minnesota's legislative races. There are 201 of them that are going to be competed for here in 2020. And Walker, I got to imagine this has to be an overwhelming task to put together, to try to get this list put together. And then obviously you have to put which party everyone's running in and where the districts are. And it's a really helpful map that you guys have over at MinnPost.com, where it lists every district and then kind of what region it is in the state. So it's very, very helpful, but I imagine that has to be a little bit time consuming, but it is helpful though to look and see who is actually running.
Yeah, we've been working on this here and there for weeks now. And I really, for example, yesterday I spent, you know, about 10 hours just working on this alone, or I guess maybe it was the day before, right before it published. But, it's a haul. I mean, all the little pieces of information about everybody. Some people have announced publicly. Some people have, you know, a candidate committee, and we've got to go call, hey, are you actually running? That sort of thing. We were talking to people from, you know, the campaign, the House Democratic campaign, the Senate, you know, Republican campaign. You know, we kind of go to the caucus campaigns and say, who do you know that's running and what kind of information do you have? And then we go try and find all that and bring it all together. My longstanding gripe shared by some of my colleagues is that there are too many legislators in Minnesota. And so there's a lot of names because there's a lot of seats out there. And I know that it's possible that we're even missing people as is. So if you happen to know somebody who's still running for office and is running for office, you can definitely email us and let us know, and we're happy to put it on this list. But as far as we know, and especially because people haven't officially filed for office yet, this is that's kind of to come in later months. This is hopefully a pretty complete look at what we know as of now, though it's expected to change as endorsements continue to go, and some people will drop out and some people will announce and that sort of stuff. But we're going to change it as we go.
Yeah, and it's helpful, too, like I mentioned. It lists all of the districts and who's running in there, but more importantly, it says what region that district represents, because oftentimes people will say, for instance, well, 45B or 63A, what exactly do those districts mean? So that's helpful, and I think it's important to point out, too, you guys are going to keep this updated throughout the year as well over at MinPost.com, correct?
Correct, and also not just do we list the region, but if we have a little button next to each district that says show on map, and it brings up a pretty nifty map that's, you can see exactly where the district is, and I think that's super helpful.
So as we take a look at some of these races, I know you have a particular focus on some of the races in outstate Minnesota. Let's talk about these regional population centers like Rochester or St. Cloud or Moorhead or Duluth, because at least in my mind, those are probably the areas where control of the state legislature is going to be decided. So talk about some of those races in those regional population centers that jumped out at you that might be very competitive this fall.
Of course. And one thing to note is we're still sort of getting a sense of this. And, there will be future announcements of candidates and stuff. And there's going to be a lot of important races in the suburbs as well. But I focus mainly on Greater Minnesota, and there's definitely action out there. One place I'm looking at is Rochester. That's an interesting one because after redistricting, there's the potential for Democrats to really actually make some inroads there, which is one of the few places that they can actually potentially add seats in Greater Minnesota. Some districts now encompass a greater slice of Rochester, basically. Like, for example, I was talking about Senator Senjum. His district in Rochester used to have a lot more rural areas kind of to the west of Rochester and now really encompasses much more of the city itself. And his district is going to be really, really difficult for him, just much more Democratic. St. Cloud is going to be another just really intense swing district. It was last cycle. Eric Putnam, a senator from St. Cloud, won his election in 2020 by like a really ultra slim margin. Votes in, I think, the teens or something like that. So that's going to be hotly contested and potentially the House seats in that area as well. Moorhead area is really interesting. Democrats had two legislators in that area who won in districts that voted for Trump really heavily. And so that's Kent Eakin, who's a state senator, and that's Paul Marquardt, who's a state representative from Dilworth. And their districts are, very heavily Republican when it comes to the top of the ticket. But they have managed to, over the years, win in increasingly difficult sort of races. And both of them are retiring now. And so Republicans think that they can pick up both those seats, and that would probably be pretty important. Another area that will be of interest is the Iron Range. There's some seats still that the Democrats have that Republicans would like to win and think they've got a good shot at. One of those is the district held by Rob Eklund, who's a Democrat from International Falls. There's three Republicans running against him there. That will be a really good and interesting one to watch. There's a seat that Julie Sandstead won just barely last time around that will be hotly contested this time. And actually, she is now in the same district as State Representative Spencer Igo from Grand Rapids, who's a Republican. And so they will have two incumbents, for now at least, facing off against each other. And in the Senate, you've got Tom Boxseat, who's retiring, who's the former Democrat who became an independent. And so that will be a hotly contested matchup, as will, replacing Senator David Tomasoni, who's also retiring, who also was a Democrat who became an independent. And so those are just a few seats up on the range and kind of the Arrowhead, but there's a lot of action up in those parts.
Yeah, and I imagine the Republicans most certainly are going to be targeting those Bach and Tomasoni seats up on the Iron Range, since those, as you said, were longtime DFL seats until Bach and Tomasoni decided to caucus as independents. Again, you can find a full list of all of those races over at minpost.com. Really helpful guide to figure out who is running for all 201 of Minnesota's seats in the state legislature. We have been speaking with Walker Orenstein, who reports on the state legislature for MinPost. Find his work over again at minpost.com. Walker, thanks so much for joining me on the show today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
All right, let's take a break and send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.
AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. You know, I've decided once again, if you don't know, that this last year, because of the Council of the Conference of Catholic Bishops, U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, and their desire to basically turn Catholicism into a weapon against Democrats, I left the Catholic Church. I'm going to go over the folks over at Charis there, the ecumenical Catholic community. Very nice. I've been over there. Trish is a regular listener. They're doing theirs, their Easter Mass. Here's the, how about this? I love this. Saturday night. I love that. They're doing it Saturday night, 7 o'clock, over at what, Prairie Lutheran and, in Eden Prairie. I'm going to go to that service because I'll tell you what, it's, yeah. I love a good sunrise service. Not many churches are doing them. Not many churches are doing them. So I'm going to do it Saturday night. So I'll see you over there. Have a good weekend, no matter what you're doing, no matter what your faith in, if you even have a faith, no matter what you're doing, have a good weekend. I hope you have a good time. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Kudos to Mark, who chimed in a little earlier in regards to the Jensen story from the first hour, who said that basically his argument, Jensen's argument, is you can't say they died of COVID because if they had diabetes, they were going to die of diabetes, which is not necessarily true. And the argument is basically if they were going to die of anything else, you can't say it was COVID. And that's just ludicrous. So, but Mark said, I'm diabetic and he's an idiot. But then he says, as a human being, I think he's an idiot. So there you go. Mark, kudos to you. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. So let's look, I want to get into something here in regards to the race for governor. And well, the race is for the all the state here because the money numbers are important. Walz is a powerhouse right now. Tim Walz has $4 million on hand. $4,124,000 on hand. That's called a war chest right there. And yeah, he's going to be able to control a lot of the airwaves across the state. The Republicans, it's interesting. Jensen's number two. He's just a smidge behind at 74,000. So yeah, a little less than 3,200,000 behind. Gazelka, God, Paul Gazelka, you're just getting beat by Scott Jensen, man. 406. Kendall Qualls comes at 168. Stanek, who I hope you recover finally there, sir, even though I won't vote for you. Hopefully you'll recover from that accent. 40,000. Michelle Benson, gosh, how long is Benson going to be in this race? 38,000. That's all she has on hand. Michelle, she has $38,000 on hand. That's it. Corey Heppola, $25,000. He's not even a Republican, though. He's running as an independent there. Neil Shah has got $22 million. And Mike Murphy is the business owner. He's a far right guy. Isn't he the far right guy? He's at $2 million or $2,000. That's it. So $22,000 for Neil Shah. And Mike Murphy is at 2,000. To give you an idea of how much ahead of everyone else Governor Walz is, if you took everyone else's money, he'd still have 2 million plus more than everyone else. That's called dominating right now. Now, granted, it will get once we get one candidate, it's going to be there. It'll be, you know, a little bit more competitive, but how much more? By the way, here's the thing, which is really interesting. Kendall Qualls in the first quarter of 2022 outraised all the rest of the Republican candidates by a mile, too. I mean, he was 467,000 in the first quarter. Jensen was 256,000. Stanek, 149,000. Gazelka, 99. His campaign's starting to flounder, man. His campaign is starting to flounder.
Maybe they should have done that lobbyist little
grotto. The grotto would have been delightful, man.
Could have raised more money.
One thing that's interesting, Kendall Qualls, he raised $467,000 in the first quarter, but he has only $168,000 on hand. Okay. Still, Tim Walz is with cash on hand is over $1 million. So, yeah, he's doing well. The DFL caucuses have outraised the GOP in both chambers. The Senate DFL has additional more money than the Senate GOP. Let's put it that way. The House DFL by about 100,000 more than the House GOP. Here's where it gets really interesting. The state DFL party has raised 50 times more than the state Republican Party. The Republicans just don't seem to understand the concept of fundraising at all. The DFL has $1,500,000 cash on hand. The GOP has 53,000. Cash contributions are $2,300,000 for the DFL. For the Republicans, it's 45,000. That's just unbelievable. That's unbelievable how badly they're getting beaten on the fundraising.
I mean, you said 50 times? I mean, I would think times. 2 times more would be quite the disparity, not 50.
You know, here's the deal, though. And we already know that I was looking at there is the housing story that I kind of alluded to a little bit earlier today, where they're talking about the housing. And of course, it's funny because the media in this town, no matter what, does take a narrative of towards the conservatives. And a great example of that is the same media outlets that were talking about, nobody wants to move into Minneapolis, are now like, why is it so unfair that everyone wants to move into Minneapolis? Because you can't find a house in the Twin Cities. And they will always try to find the spin. But even with this obscene money advantage, if the media is constantly just spewing out the right-wing talking points, this is about equal. And this doesn't count all the dark money that's going to come on into this race to try to help the Republicans. Democrats, I have to take you to task, though. Your messaging so far has been atrocious on a statewide level. I brought up the Education Minnesota, the teachers union, had a wonderful meme on social media where, in case you missed it, the Senate Republicans have put zero money for schools in their bill. And the Education Minnesota went with that and said, they basically put out a internet meme where it brought up every school district in the state. And it showed how much money the DFL was going to give that school. And it compared it to the $0 the Republicans in the Senate were going to give it. And it didn't matter which district it was in. It was an obscene difference. And the argument was, we have a massive, massive budget surplus. Why are the Republicans refusing to help out schools? And it was fantastic. And I said the DFL should be out there today with that in every school district in the state. They should have that on a billboard in every school district in the state. It's kind of fallen by the wayside. I don't know what they're waiting for as far as, I get it. You want to pace yourself. You don't want to spend all your money in April and May, but you should be starting out there and trying to counterpoint some of this stuff so that the Republican narratives never have a chance to develop. Because one of the problems that Democrats have when it comes to messaging is that they have a tendency of being reactionary as opposed to proactive. The Republicans will start sitting out there and they'll start coming on out. Although Jensen clearly isn't yet, where did you ever get the idea we were against vaccines? Where did you get this? Well, the second they, before they even say that, you should be hitting the airwaves with a, well, look at this clown car of a crew. They basically, a lot of them are against vaccines. And yet that doesn't happen. Not until 3 or 4 months down the road, and all of a sudden someone over at the DFL says, hey, wait a minute, people are starting to think the Republicans were pro-vaccine. Maybe we should spend some money on that. You got an opportunity here to take these clowns out. And frankly, and I will say this, and this is not just the DFL here in the state of Minnesota, if the Democrats nationwide do not trounce the Republicans, I don't know how much longer I'm going to stick in the DFL at this point. And I'm dead serious. I know that's a harsh thing to say, but I don't know. Let's understand what the Republicans are running on. They have vocally said, we're going to raise taxes for the middle and lower class and kill Social Security. They're campaigning on that. They're campaigning on that. And sure, Republican voters are like, yeah. And then when it comes time to raise their taxes, they're like, I thought you were going to raise taxes only on the Democrats. I still vote Republican. I get it. They're brainwashed. But my God, they have handed you the lowest of lowest hanging fruit there. They say they want to raise taxes on the middle and lower class and kill Social Security. Where in the hell are the ads against that? Oh, I get it. They might have run one ad in Washington, D.C. as all the Democrats sit around a TV and pat themselves on the back about the good job they did with that one ad that aired during the one segment on MSNBC. Didn't we do a good job? That should be a nationwide ad campaign in every state in the country. Republicans proudly saying they're going to raise your taxes and kill Social Security. Sweet Jesus, if you can't win against that, then what in the hell can you win against? I'll bring up the other 2 points I have been hitting heavily for the last few weeks, which is, one, we just came out of a pandemic. 12,000 people died in the state. Almost 1.5 million people were sick. And the Republicans have, through their antics, have bankrupted a lot of Minnesotans with medical debt. We are the, and I've talked about the ad. You have the farmstead. You have the voiceover. My great grandfather lived here. My grandfather lived here. My dad lived here, and I lived here. And we've all voted Republican for 100 years. But they told me not to get vaccinated. They told me not to wear a mask. I've lost 2 family members. I've had 2 other family members spend extended periods of time in the hospital. I now have got more medical debt than I could possibly pay off in a lifetime, and I'm probably going to have to sell my farm. I will never vote Republican again, paid for by the DFL. Dear Lord, that writes itself, doesn't it? It writes itself, doesn't it? And it's true. And it's true. You couldn't beat that. My God, Republicans will be furious at that ad because it's brutal, but factual. The other side of it, they're loon balls. They're loony. They're nutbags. They really are. They're all cray cray. None of them have the guts to come out and say, well, I think that Donald Trump might have actually lost the 2020 election. What? How dare you? Rhino. They can't do that. They can't come out and say, you know, I understand people are passionate and all, but I just don't think storming the Capitol on January 6th was patriotic or American. I thought that was very anti-American. How dare you? Trump. That's they can't do that. So grab the whitest paintbrush you've got and paint away. That is the party that thinks January 6th was perfectly okay, showing them beating cops with sticks on the Capitol steps. Heck, if you could get away with it, I'd show the smeared feces on the wall of the Capitol, because that was pretty disturbing. These are the same people that, even though the courts have found no evidence of wrongdoing, are still convinced that there's wrongdoing. For God's sakes, those three things alone. The Republicans are going to raise taxes and kill Social Security. The Republicans are the party of death when it came to the pandemic. And the Republican Party is loony. They're crazy. You've got the money advantage. Why aren't you out there with those ads right now in every market in the state, in the country? And yeah, it's going to cost a lot, but you get out there and you fight their narratives before they're put out there. And those ads would all be so good that the Republicans would demand they were all taken off the air. Not because they're not true, because they're doing damage. Democrats, if you can't win when the other side's talking about raising taxes and killing Social Security, then you're broken. And that's just that. You should be able to wallop them. And instead, I see way too many Democrats, especially in leadership positions, talking about, well, we're already preparing for major losses. Really? To the guys that want to raise your taxes and, wow, that is called quitting. Find your spines, get that money, that money advantage, start spending it, and go on the offensive. Because right now, the Republicans are begging you to sit back and just worry and fret and wring your hands and go, we're going to lose. And what they don't want you to do is stand up and punch them in the face. And those ads will punch them in the face. Trust me. I'm not condoning violence, but you get my point. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. Dance into the Easter weekend when we do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. Chicken expert, you say? Okay. Are they dressed as a chicken? I'm just going to ask. It would be great. That's what, 7 o'clock on Saturday there?
Yeah, 7 a.m. Saturdays and Sundays, indeed.
Right here tomorrow. Make sure you're listening right here on AM 950. Thank you, Brett. You've been filling in. Patrick's been gone for a little bit. Thank you very much. And next week, Patrick comes back. I appreciate all the fill-in, and I appreciate once again yesterday you, Gregory, Rich, and the crew filling in on short notice there. We, of course, encourage you, have a wonderful weekend. Passover, Easter, no matter what you're celebrating, have a wonderful time there. All my best. Drive safe if you're heading out on the roads there, and hopefully the snow will melt some for you if you're up in the northern part of the state. The Easter parade. Let's take a little sojourn, shall we? Judy Garland and crew from the movie from a long time ago. It is taking us out this week. Have a great weekend. We are back on a Monday. Until then, see ya.
You look quite so pretty before. Never saw you dress quite so handsome. What's more, I could hardly wait to keep our days this lovely Easter morning. And my heart beat fast as I came through the door. For in your Easter bonnet, with all the frills upon it, you'll be the grandest fellow in the Easter parade. I'll be all in clover, and when they look us over, we'll be the proudest couple in the Easter parade. On the avenue, Fifth Avenue, photographers will snap us, and you'll find that you're in the rotogravure. Oh, I could write a sonnet about your Easter bonnet and of the guy I'm taking to the Easter parade.
On the avenue, Fifth Avenue, the photographers will snap us, and you'll find that you're in the road of gravure.